Africa and the politics of change today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Change is in the air for Ethiopians, Somalis, and Eritreans. They're talking to each other again as years of violence and tension in their part of Africa give way to dialogue.
Now for the first time, we're together. This is something we have never seen in our life.
Also, a presidential election in Zimbabwe, the first since longtime ruler Robert Mugabe was forced to resign last year.
The last time we had such determination to vote was 1980, the independence election, which Robert Mugabe won.
Change is not in the air in Cameroon, though. The president there wants to extend his 36 years in power and appears out of touch.
The president doesn't seem to go out of his way to associate with ordinary people.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us this Monday. We're going to spend the first half of the show today focusing on Africa, a part of the globe that rarely gets the coverage it deserves. We're changing that today, and we start in, of all places, Minnesota. The Target Center in Minneapolis is the home of the Minnesota Timberwolves. Today, though, the Target Center was not packed with NBA fans. This crowd was going wild for a politician.
We have a new prime minister in office, and he has been basically changing the country for the better.
That's Fatuma Bedasso, and like most of the crowd, she's Ethiopian-American. And the new prime minister she's talking about is Abiy Ahmed, who is on a three-city U.S. tour, including Minneapolis.
He's changed a lot, and there's also a lot of reforms that are taking place right now that are giving us hope that things will change for the better. So that's why we're here to, you know, welcome him to Little Minnesota here and just show our appreciation for the change that's taken place and encourage that change going forward for the betterment of our country.
Those changes include making peace with neighboring Eritrea, freeing thousands of political prisoners, fighting corruption, and putting a stop to ethnic conflict within Ethiopia. Minnesota is home to one of the largest Ethiopian populations in the U.S. Broadcaster Ahmed Wasi was also at the Target Center today. I caught up with him earlier, just before the speeches began.
It's really hard to explain in my life, probably, that I was going to see this kind of situation. To see 20,000 Ethiopians happening here at the Target Center and coming from all kind of ethnic groups from Ethiopia. So I don't know. It's hard for me. I'm overwhelmed with everybody, and, you know, for a long time we have been divided. For the first time, we just wake up 3 months ago, and we found, you know, a saint in Ethiopia. We think that's going to, you know, maybe unite us together. So it's a great situation, that's all.
A saint, I mean, that's a pretty big word for the new prime minister. Why do you think people are so excited by the visit of the new Ethiopian prime minister, Abiy Ahmed, there in Minneapolis?
Well, you know, I say saint because that's my line, not everybody else. But to me, this guy came over, and he actually, you know, brought the people together for the first time. Everybody believed what he thinks he's gonna do. So this guy said, "There is peace. Let's work together." And you know, again, different ethnic groups were splinting from the government. Now, for the first time, we're together. Today, we see. And Target Center, we see the Oromo flag flying, Amharas grind, other ethnic groups. But, you know, this is something we have never seen in our life. I mean, I'm 65 years old, and, you know, I think it's a great time. I think we see, for the first time, we see democracy working. It's really, I'm too excited even to answer these questions.
I can tell. So, Ahmed, give us a sense of what Ethiopians in Minneapolis are feeling, because I know you've got a weekly radio show every Sunday, Voices of Ethiopia. What kind of calls were you getting yesterday? What were you hearing?
People were so elated. They were happy. People have questions now. There are people that, in my radio show yesterday, they said, you know, they don't trust this guy. Because, you know, what kind of government is going to be in Ethiopia in the future? And is there going to be free election in the country? I can understand their view. I'm not a child. I don't think this guy is going to solve all the problem in Ethiopia. But now at least he's opening the door. He's making Ethiopians to, you know, to get ready for new generation and unity.
Ahmed Wasi hosts Voices of Ethiopia in Minneapolis every Sunday. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Marco.
There's a wave of political change sweeping across the Horn of Africa, that part of the continent that juts out on its eastern flank like a horn. Ethiopia and Eritrea signed a peace agreement that ended 20 years of hostility. That was earlier this month. You might have heard the interview we did about Ethiopians and Eritreans, complete strangers, dialing each other up on the phone just to talk. And then over the weekend, more good news. Eritrea and Somalia reestablished diplomatic relations for the first time in 15 years. Yohannes Gedamu is a political science professor at Georgia Gwinnett College. He joins us from his home in Georgia. So what's going on in the Horn of Africa? Why are all these changes happening now, Yohannes?
African politics is showing to be very much elite-driven. At the end of the day, elites and their strategic interests really matter. So now, with the coming of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, you see that very much the political scene is changing, and they are coming with new reform agenda that not only is impacting political change in Ethiopia on the ground, but also across the region.
Clearly, the new Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, he's also an elite. Are you saying he just has kind of a different touch with the average Ethiopian, with the people on the street?
Absolutely. For the last several years, we have seen that as the people protested on the streets, strikes were very much heard across the nation. Some elites were siding with the public, and he happened to be one of these reformers. So, of course, he's part of the establishment, but an individual, despite his affiliations among the political elite, he wanted reform. So that is what excited Ethiopians the most.
So separate from Ethiopia, what do Eritrea and Somalia have to gain at this point?
Regional stability is very much key. Somalia has been also serving as a battleground for the proxy war between Ethiopia and Eritrea. So if these countries are now discussing economic integration, common agenda that's basically taking them towards stability and higher connected programs for their citizens, building trust is key.
Are there factions in the Horn of Africa that are not happy about all this political reconciliation going on?
Absolutely, because in Somalia or the warring factions in the South Sudan and even in Eritrea, some Eritrean diaspora elites are not very much happy. Despite they are happy with the peace deal with Ethiopia, they are not happy with politics in Eritrea. And they want to make sure that reforms at home in Eritrea must take place. So there are so many flurries of opposition, and that shows that everything is not really rosy. But at least the kind of positive energy that we are observing today somehow signals that there are better days ahead.
The U.S. military had really found a place for itself in the Horn of Africa, especially after 9/11. How do you think the U.S. sees these changes that are breaking out in the Horn right now?
It is extremely important for the United States to understand that it still can play a critical role. Because in China, we find that for the first time in their history, they have actually established a military base in Djibouti, which is less than 100 miles away from Ethiopian borders.
Right.
That's the new reality. United States' role in the region has been very much in decline, especially in the last 4 or 5 years. Before that, Ethiopia was a launching ground and a counter-terrorism ally against militants like Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Now they have to actually make sure that they also involve in this project of building democratic institutions.
So a personal question for you, Yohannes, to end on. You're from Ethiopia, and you've been deeply invested in all of this news coming out of your home country. How are you reacting when you see really what are startling changes in the region? How does that make you feel?
I have never, ever expected that such forms of reforms could be witnessed this time around. Because really, what we were witnessing was news about torture of prisoners, human rights abuses. We have never, ever seen someone like Abiy who acknowledged that all these crimes against humanity in his country basically show that the regime in power was committing terroristic acts, and that was very much mind-blowing.
Yohannes Gedamu, a professor of political science at Georgia Gwinnett College. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Now to Zimbabwe, which is being put to its first democratic test in a long time. Remember that until last year when he was pushed out of power, Robert Mugabe, who's now 94, ruled over Zimbabwe for 37 years. And up until recently, Zimbabweans were certain that this election, like others before it, would return Mugabe and his loyalists to power. This was a country in which hope had long ago been smothered, smothered by Mugabe himself. But this morning, starting well before sunrise, Zimbabweans lined up to vote, knowing that there was at least the possibility of a decisive break with the past. Miles Tendi is an associate professor in African politics at Oxford University, and he's been observing the elections in Zimbabwe. So just tell us about the mood where you are right now. Tell us where you are exactly.
I'm in Harare, the capital city. I did a tour of quite a number of the polling stations earlier today. Voting is now officially closed. The mood itself, there's been a great determination to vote. Been a massive voter turnout in Harare at least, and I'm getting reports from other parts of the country that the turnout is high. Peaceful environment, but very great determination to vote.
Mm. And what do you attribute that massive turnout to?
I think everybody realizes it's a momentous election. The last time we had such determination to vote was 1980, the independence election, which Robert Mugabe won. And this is the first election in the post-Robert Mugabe era. So this is partly that. For much of the electorate, they realize that there's a potential for change. But for those in ZANU-PF who also support ZANU-PF, they're also keen to sustain ZANU-PF rule.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds kind of like a contradiction. A lot of people want change, and then there are a lot of people who want the same old ruling party of ZANU-PF.
I think the other key dynamic that's driven high voter turnout has been your so-called youth vote. Mm. A lot of young people were disconnected from mainstream politics, but I think the opposition leader, Nelson Chamisa, has been able to excite or capture the imagination of young people.
So tell us a bit more about that sea change and what people who desire change, what they actually want.
I think it's jobs, creation of jobs, getting the economy working again. The country doesn't have a currency of its own. Basic public services have basically broken down. The education system as well. This used to be one of the things you used to pride yourself about Zimbabwe was the high standards of the education system. So building that up too. So I think it's those kind of things.
Do you have any sense at this stage of which candidate and which party might emerge victorious? What do you expect to see tomorrow morning?
Very hard to say. But what's also significant to say is that despite the high turnout, there have been reports of the voting process taking longer than it should. Some people turning up to polling stations and realizing that their name is not at that particular polling station, but a different one, a distance away. And in an area called Glenview in Harare, actually the polling station being non-existent. So there are concerns that there's been an attempt to frustrate the urban vote, which is seen as traditionally pro the opposition. And in the countryside as well, getting reports about how, for instance, voting closed at 7 p.m. By 5 p.m., the sun is already setting. How there was simply no lighting.
Well, whether it is a clean break with the past or kind of giving life support to the ruling ZANU-PF, it has to have been an emotional day there. I mean, tell us what you saw.
The determination to vote, the will, very high. And remarkable also was Robert Mugabe voting in Highfield. It's a constituency in Harare. He came out yesterday, gave a press conference where he basically stated that he was not going to vote for Emmerson Mnangagwa and his old party ZANU-PF, and would prefer to vote for Nelson Chamisa and the MDC because he thought they were the more viable entity. So he voted in Highfield, a constituency in Harare. Harare is the part of Zimbabwe, you know, the world would have seen the hundreds of thousands who came out to march for him to resign last November. But lo and behold, when he showed up in Highfield to cast his votes, those who were gathered there to cast their own votes were chanting his name and
really
calling him a hero. That for me, that was one of the remarkable things of today, to see him casting his vote for the opposition, as he had said, and him being cheered like a hero as he was leaving. And he acknowledged that. He raised his fists. He clapped his hands and then entered his black limousine and left.
Yeah, Robert Mugabe doesn't seem to go away. He just seems to continually be able to adapt.
No, yeah, still looming, a looming shadow in the background.
Miles Tendi, associate professor in African politics at Oxford University, speaking with us from Harare in Zimbabwe. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
More from Africa, unsettling news from Cameroon, that's coming up after the break. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We were just hearing before the break some good news about African leaders, from the charismatic new prime minister of Ethiopia, who seems to be building a reputation as a peacemaker, to the elections today in Zimbabwe, the first seemingly free and fair elections there in decades. Right now, though, a less optimistic story about leadership on the continent. It's from Cameroon, which sits on the Atlantic, right where West Africa turns into Central Africa. Africa's next civil war could be in Cameroon. That's a recent headline from the Washington Post. Here's what we know. Villages in Cameroon are being burned and government forces have fired on protesters. The president of Cameroon, Paul Biya, addressed some of this during a televised speech on National Youth Day back in February.
Mes chers jeunes compatriotes.
My dear young compatriots, the last few years have not been easy for our country, which has had to take up simultaneously several major challenges, namely addressing the Boko Haram threat in the northern regions and that of armed gangs on our eastern border.
Earlier this month, Paul Biya announced he'll run for re-election in October. Keep in mind, Biya is 86 years old, and he's been in power already for 36 years. That makes him the second longest-serving president in Africa. But here's the thing. Paul Biya is rarely in Cameroon. He spends most of his time ruling the country from Switzerland or France. John Mukum Mbaku is a professor at Weber University in Ogden, Utah. He's also from Cameroon. Professor Mbaku, thanks for being with us. I mean, there's a lot to unpack here, but I think for Cameroon 101, I want to focus on President Paul Biya. Paul Biya has been called this absentee president, and yet he's probably going to be heading into his fourth decade as ruler. Do most Cameroonians even know he's not in the country most of the time?
Not really. Part of the problem has to do with the fact that newspapers, radios, and even the internet in Cameroon are controlled very closely by the government. People only get the information that the government wants them to get. So sometimes when the president is out of the country, it's often quite difficult for the ordinary person to know that the president is not there. Even if he's in the country, it's also quite difficult to find out if he's there, primarily because the president doesn't seem to go out of his way to associate with ordinary people the way a government is supposed to interact with its own people. So it's very difficult for Cameroonians to know if the president is there or if he's not there.
So the recent news reports out of Cameroon have been pretty troubling. Cameroonian troops seem to have gone after Boko Haram militants, as is their mandate, but they've been shooting at peaceful demonstrators. Women and children have been attacked. In a nutshell, what's going on?
The government is using laws against terrorism to make it difficult for people to express genuine disaffection against the government.
How much have these troops been getting orders directly from Paul Biya or his administration? Is there any way to know?
Well, it's very difficult to know. For one thing, if you have read news narratives about Mr. Biya, is that he held a cabinet meeting in March of this year. And it was rumored that that was the first cabinet meeting he's held in 3 years. So whether or not individuals are getting the instructions directly from Mr. Biya is very difficult to determine. But we have to assume that if you are the president of the country, you're responsible for everything that is done in your name. So even if those people are not getting directions from him, they are acting on his behalf. And if he is the president, he is responsible for the behaviors of those people.
I mean, it's quite interesting what you say, because when it comes to Western governments like the United States criticizing Cameroon and Paul Biya for this, I mean, the U.S. and these governments have their own pursuit of terror around the globe. Do you think the U.S. government is going to criticize Paul Biya when civilians are getting killed?
Actually, there have been some criticisms by the Trump administration about the nature of what is going on in Cameroon. Mm. They haven't been as strong as Anglophones would have wanted the U.S. government to do. But I think that the problem for the U.S. government is that on the one hand, the U.S. government wants Paul Biya to cooperate with them in the struggle against transnational terrorism in West Africa. But on the other hand, the U.S. must be aware of the fact that there are a lot of human rights abuses occurring in Cameroon, especially with respect to the burning down of villages and the killing of peaceful demonstrators. So that balance must be made by the U.S. because the U.S. is the one democracy in the world that stands up for individual liberties, and the country cannot simply stand silent and allow what is going on in Cameroon to continue.
Now, you underscored the Anglophones just now. Cameroon has an English-speaking part and a French part, and the English parts of the country have been forced to assimilate. How much has that been behind the tension and violence, the recent tension and violence in Cameroon?
I think that is one of the most important decision factors in the way Anglophones are behaving right now, primarily because when the reunification took place in 1961, the Anglophones and the Francophones were supposed to have institutions that were to be respected. And Anglophones were ensured, or rather assured, that their institutions would be maintained. For example, they would continue with common law. They would continue with English as a method of instruction in schools, also in commercial areas, and so on and so on. But what has happened over the years is that the Francophones have gradually tried to assimilate Anglophones into the French system and literally wipe out their institutions.
And now Human Rights Watch has raised the alarm of human rights abuses in Cameroon. If the Washington Post headline I quoted earlier is correct, if a civil war should tragically settle on Cameroon, would the narrative essentially be that post-colonial Cameroon will have drawn sides in a civil war based on who the colonial powers were, i.e. France and Great Britain?
Well, yeah, that would really be unfortunate because the problem we have in the country in Cameroon now is that there is not that effort to engage people in actually discussing what the problem is. The president is assuming that he understands what the problem is. So I think that going forward, the most important way to avoid civil war is to sit down and go through a process in which people are actually allowed to articulate their problems without fear that they may end up being labeled terrorists and as a result treated brutally for that.
Cameroonians will go to the polls in October. If Biya wins, he could rule to 2025. He'd be 93. How much would a Biya victory bring Cameroon closer to civil conflict?
Well, I think that most Cameroonians were hoping that Mr. Biya would not run for another term in office. But he's announced that he is. And the chances that he will get elected are very good because many members in the opposition who were planning to run against him have been getting out so that they make it possible for him to win. And so if he becomes president again, I believe that many people in the Anglophone parts of Cameroon are going to lose faith in the government in that they don't believe that the government would be willing to listen to them and try to solve the problems that they've been complaining about.
John Mukum Mbaku is a professor at Weber University in Ogden, Utah. Thank you very much for bringing us up to speed on what's going on in Cameroon. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
I'm Marco Werman. President Trump threatens again to shut down the government if Congress doesn't provide funding for a border wall. Many lawmakers would rather he hold off on that.
I think what Republicans are hoping for at this point is that any threat to shut down the government comes after the midterm election.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. President Trump has threatened, via Twitter and then in person this afternoon, to shut down the government if Congress doesn't approve funding for more border security, including a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. If that sounds familiar, that's because it's the third time that Trump has threatened to veto a spending bill over immigration policy. But if this shutdown goes into effect on October 1st, it could have a major impact on the GOP during the midterm elections in November. Anna Edgerton is a reporter with Bloomberg. She joins us from Washington. Just remind us what's already in the budget for a border wall, if you would, Anna.
So House Republicans have proposed a budget that would include $5 billion for President Trump's border wall. And in the Senate, they've appropriated $1.6 billion. So what will happen is that that appropriations bill will pass in the House, pass in the Senate, and then they'll finalize which amount they'll actually end up appropriating for this project.
And is there any way to know now what Trump is likely to get? And is $5 billion exactly what he wants, or does he want more?
Well, eventually he wants $25 billion, and they already appropriated $1.6 billion in fiscal year 2018. So what they're deciding on right now is the amount for fiscal year 2019. And I'll remind you that the immigration bills that House Republicans tried to pass a few months ago included full funds appropriated over the next 8 years for this border wall. Those bills, however, didn't pass, in part because the president helped torpedo them with a tweet.
How much support is there on both sides of the aisle for this?
Well, it depends on how it's packaged. Appropriations bills are usually packaged in what we call mini-buses when a few of the bills will be put together, or an omnibus when all 12 appropriations bills are packaged together. So Democrats certainly don't want to use a lot of federal funds for this border wall, but if it's packaged with something that's more acceptable to Democrats, there could be broader support for this. I think what Republicans are hoping for at this point is that any threat to shut down the government comes after the midterm election. So funding for this fiscal year runs out October 1st. So if they can pass a stopgap measure to get us past the midterm elections, then they'd be much more willing to indulge the president in whatever kind of funding fight he wants to have.
House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell met with Trump last week to try and avoid a shutdown. Do we know what they discussed?
Well, it was really interesting because just the day after that meeting, House Speaker Paul Ryan told us that they had a unified strategy to fund the government this year, and that the president understood how important it is for this to go smoothly. And then this tweet over the weekend left some doubt as to whether he really took Ryan and McConnell's message to heart to not rock the boat right before they ask Americans to reelect them.
I'm curious, among the GOP in Washington, do you have a sense of how much the emotional debate over separating children from their families that crossed the border, how much has that damaged Trump's fortunes on getting what he wants here?
The response that we saw from House Republicans varied a lot depending on their district. You'll have some Republicans from deep red districts that are a lot more willing to indulge a zero tolerance policy, even if that means separating children from their parents, whereas Republicans from swing districts are going to be a lot more sensitive to those images and a lot more worried about how independents view this kind of policy. One thing I will point out, though, is that a lot of Republicans, especially Will Hurt from Texas, he's a Republican who has the longest stretch of border in his district. He says that a wall is not the best way to defend the border, that you need smart technology, cameras, drones to ensure that the border is secured. He calls Trump's border wall a fourth century technology.
Trump and his base's determination to get this wall, how do you think this looks to the rest of the world? Because there are some leaders in some other countries who, like Trump, think a wall, either real or metaphorical, is the answer to all their immigration problems.
Well, I think we're in a really interesting moment, not just in the United States, but also in global geopolitics, where you see nativist, anti-immigrant rhetoric in other countries where politicians are rewarded for preserving what they perceive as the national identity, their national culture, and warning about the dangers of unbounded immigration. So I think as we see this becoming more accepted, there could be less global pushback against Trump's demands for a border wall.
Anna Edgerton, a reporter with Bloomberg. She joined us from Washington. Really appreciate your time, Anna. Thanks.
Thank you.
Sometimes the U.S. legal system works to correct its errors, but when those errors involve immigration, righting wrongs can be grueling, time-consuming, and all but impossible. Consider what happened to Herbert Cortez Gaitan. Cortez was drafted to serve in Guatemala's military during its bloody civil war. After he was discharged, he was targeted by rebels who wanted him dead. So in 1990, he fled to the U.S. He applied for asylum and spent 16 years building a life here in America. When the U.S. government finally heard his case, his application was denied, and he was deported back to Guatemala. But he didn't give up. Ultimately, his asylum appeal succeeded. Still, his problems did not end there.
It's much easier to get out or to be pushed out or to be deported than to come back.
That's reporter Tiziana Rinaldi. She described for us the Cortez family's odyssey.
They filed for asylum in 1991, and by the time Herbert was called by USCIS.
That's Citizenship and Immigration Services.
Correct. To be interviewed for his asylum application, 16 years had gone by.
Wow, 16 years.
16 years, that long. It was 2007. And so, of course, the family had grown. Now they had more children. And they were just going by with their lives. So they had been waiting all that time. And then he was called for the interview. And their asylum is rejected.
So some years later, in fact, in August of 2016, Cortez got deported from the U.S. What were the grounds for his deportation?
The courts, both the immigration court and the Board of Immigration Appeals, decided that because he had been in the military, in the Guatemalan military, they felt that he might have been on the side of the oppressor instead of the oppressed.
So you spoke with his family about what that moment was like, about hearing this decision, about the deportation. Let's hear from Elio Cortez Perez. This is Cortez's 21-year-old son, about how he took the news.
We've always lived in that fear, you know, of, like, being separated. So, like, when that actually happened, it was like the nightmare came true. And I was going to have to face this without having dad.
And yet Cortez managed to appeal his deportation in the very conservative U.S. Court of Appeal for the Eighth Circuit. What did the court find this time?
The Court of Appeal, the Eighth Circuit, decided this time that actually lower courts had wrongfully deported Cortez, that the law had been not properly followed. By then, he was already in Guatemala. And that's when the family finally, after years of struggles in the courts, receives the first positive news. And that is that he can come back, that the case deserves to be reopened. Mm.
Now, as you say, Cortez was in Guatemala when this news came out. And you talked to him about that moment and what it was like. Here he is. His voice is, as you'll hear, heavy with emotion.
Fue una noticia muy grande para mí porque estaba por la enfermedad.
Yeah, he says here that it was an incredible blessing. It was such a wonderful news. It's like a door reopened, and he could finally come back and come back to be with his family, to help his family. The family had endured many difficulties during the time, the almost 2 years between the actual deportation and the separation. They still endured because it took time to bring him back.
So once the decision was made, was Cortez able to just get on a plane in Guatemala and rejoin his family in Sioux Falls, South Dakota?
Not quite. Re-entering the U.S., even though it's been established that someone, in this case Herbert Cortez Gaitan, had been wrongfully deported, it's actually a very complex and bureaucratic process. Coming back, in his case, for instance, required an extremely persevering lawyer. And finally, he manages to come back. ICE gives him the proper documentation to come back.
And let me get this straight. Cortez even had to pay his own flight back to the U.S., right?
Absolutely. He pays his own ticket, $800 from Guatemala. And that's a lot for a family who has modest means and several children. And what I'm being told is that this is actually kind of the norm. If people cannot pay their way back, well, you know, they just don't come back.
Yeah, that's incredible. Despite all this red tape and these unexpected costs, I mean, it was quite a relief to Cortez and his seven children when he got back in South Dakota. You spoke with his youngest child, Josue, who described how he felt.
Seeing my dad come back is a miracle because my dad was gone for 2 years. I didn't know what to do because my heart was broken.
Yeah.
So given the obstacles, Tiziana, to fighting and winning a deportation appeal, why do you think Cortez was successful?
Two things. One is that they persevered. They have a large network of relatives in the U.S. On both sides, and community. At some point in their lives, they both Cortez and his wife became pastors. They are pastors of a Pentecostal church. And they just had, through the help of their friends, they were able to continue their case. But they also had a lawyer who continued to ask for what he felt was the right of his client to come back, and he just didn't stop.
What do you think this case says about the larger process of deportation orders?
how complex it is, how many more barriers and complications, twists and turns there are that people don't really understand, not only the general public, but even the people going through it. Cortez Gaitan, by the way, had three lawyers. The one who really did the work to bring him back and won the case is the third one.
Reporter Tiziana Rinaldi, thanks very much for telling us this story.
Thank you for having me.
You can read the full story by Tiziana at PRI.org. Russia has one of the lowest retirement ages in the world. Age 60 for men, 55 for women. It's been that way since the Soviet days. Pretty nice, but President Putin wants to change that. Okay, maybe not so nice. In response, tens of thousands of Russians rallied across the country this weekend to protest the hike in pension age. Anders Aslund is a resident senior fellow for the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council in Washington. What exactly does this new legislation in Russia propose, Anders?
Well, it means that the retirement age for men will go up to 65, and for women to 63 from 55. This will take place during a number of years, but it will go relatively fast. And the big point is that this is a redistribution of money from the poor to the rich. And that, I think, is the reason why people protest.
So you foresee that this policy will mostly affect the poor in Russia?
Yeah, because pensions in Russia are low. And the people who really benefit from them are the poor. So this means that old or upper middle-aged people who are poor, they will suffer from it, while the rich are not really concerned about these reforms. And people see this as Putin breaking his old promise that he made early on, that as long as he is president, there would be no increase in the retirement age. And for a long period, Putin stood for political stability and rising standard of living. Now it's only political stability and no increase in the standard of living for the last 5 years.
Most of the protests I see were not enormous, but there were some decent turnouts in some cities. Who mostly showed up at these protests over the weekend?
As far as I can see on the video, it's mainly old people, as you would expect. And they have very much been driven by the Communist Party, which is by and large obedient to Putin and the Kremlin. But the Communist Party has become a trade union for the pensioners. So therefore, this has become a particularly important question for the Communist Party. But all the three support parties in the Russian Duma that normally vote with Putin all the time, they've actually voted against the pension reform.
Well, we've heard about protests over human rights, over corruption in Russia. What does Putin have to fear more? Those kinds of issues that the West and foreigners tend to glom onto, or anger over bread and butter things like pensions?
I think that the serious questions are the bread and butter, because they concern many more people. And Russia's economic performance has been so poor for many years. And this concerns very many people. And the last time Putin faced a serious social protest in early 2005, he retreated immediately. Putin has cleverly stayed away from the pension reforms, said that he's not happy with any proposal he has seen, but so he could still stop this pension reform.
Anders Aslund, resident senior fellow for the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council in Washington. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The Malaysian government released a final report on MH370. That was the Malaysian Airlines flight that went missing in March of 2014. The bottom line here, they still have no idea what happened to the plane. Kok Su Chan, the government's main investigator, says there's not enough evidence to say why the plane went off course.
The lack of evidence includes the information recorded on the flight data recorder, cockpit voice recorder, and other recording devices on the aircraft that could indicate why the aircraft had flown to the southern Indian Ocean. In conclusion, The team is unable to determine the real cause for the disappearance of the MH370.
Though there were some interesting findings in the report, like there was no systems failure, meaning that the plane was deliberately flown off course into the Indian Ocean. David Gleave is an aviation safety researcher at the University of Loughborough in the UK.
It looks like human intervention from somebody on board the aeroplane. It's not somebody sitting at home with a PC hijacking the aeroplane via a communication system or anything like that.
Gleave says some signs point to the captain.
The computer that the captain had at home had some waypoints on it. These are points that you would put into a computer to say, please fly A, B, C, D, E, F. And these waypoints look suspiciously close to those where the aeroplane actually flew on this particular course that we know from the satellite communication system and the radar data. But this is not regarded as evidence at this stage. There's nothing conclusive is drawn from it, but at least the data are there.
But other parts of the report suggest it wasn't the captain. Investigators say they conducted a full psychological evaluation of him and nothing turned up. The pilot's sister, Sakinab Shah, said she was relieved about that.
According to the reports, there was nothing negative about his character, nothing negative about the nature of his work, his professional record, his family conditions, nothing negative.
Relatives of the missing passengers don't share her relief. K.S. Narendran lost his wife on board the flight. He said the report had nothing to offer the relatives.
If I can just summarize the reaction, it's been disappointment, a sense of feeling deflated, and a sense of regurgitating what we already knew all this while. And at the end of the day, the big questions remain, and so there is no end in sight for the families, as I see it, because we still don't know what happened, why it happened, who or what was responsible.
The Boeing 777 disappeared en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing with 239 people on board. A few pieces of wreckage did wash up on African shores, but no bodies have ever been found. An official search ended in May of this year, but the government in Malaysia had said it could resume the search if more evidence emerges. We've been big fans of the Australian musician Tash Sultana ever since she played in Boston last year. Because she's gotten her sea legs back and is touring this summer, we thought we'd take this moment to introduce you to her. This is Tash Sultana's new single, Salvation. The R&B thread weaves naturally through her music. It's a sound Sultana developed when she used to busk in the streets of Melbourne. Last year when she came through town, Tash Sultana spoke with our partners here at WGBH, Front Row Boston, and told them she is greedy in her musical interests.
I like so many different types of music that I kind of am a little bit greedy with. Oh, I like that. Like, that's a bit jazzy, or that's a bit like R&B, or that's a bit soul. That's got roots, that's got blues, that's psychedelic rock and all that type of stuff, reggae, and I like hip-hop and kind of just meshes all together somewhere. I don't really have a genre. I wouldn't say I'm a genre-based artist, I just like jam.
And doing what she loves, jamming, has drawn millions to Sultana's music. In 2016, she posted a video to YouTube, just something she shot with her smartphone, and it went viral. In it, she's performing alone in her living room. She's got baggy torn pants on, her hat's on backwards, long hair flowing out. The song's called Jungle.
I know, when you write a little jam in your bedroom, you don't think anything of it, and then it just goes... Whew.
It just goes when Sultana loops her guitar and drum tracks, and she essentially falls into the metaphoric bed she's made for herself.
It's like what you enter into in your mind when you're doing something that you love, what you wholeheartedly love. And it's like it's accessed in many different ways, not just by playing music, but being creative, like painting, drawing, running, like a lot of marathon runners will access flow state, and that's why it's so addictive, because they get into this state where they're just, they're completely one, they're in complete oneness, and that's what happens to me when I play music.
And it's happened since she was busking for small change. Now that she's hit the big time, Sultana semi-jokingly has some advice for her fellow buskers.
Don't start arguments with people on meth. That's something I learned when I was busking. Don't do that. But, you know, there's a lot of people on the street. There's a lot of tortured souls out there, and it is sad to see. But not everyone's violent or anything like that. Most people just stop and listen, and they love it.
She's touring the U.S. this summer and continues all over the world this fall. Tash Sultana's new album is called Flow State. You can watch Tash Sultana's full show here at Boston's Paradise Nightclub from last year. That's courtesy of our partners at Front Row Boston. That video is at PRI.org, and that'll do it for us today. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.